are going to be starting a series this morning. Some jokes. They're going to be very bad. I mean, they're going to be very good jokes. I hope you laugh at them. Otherwise, I will probably not be offended. I didn't actually write these. So, anyways. First one is, who was the greatest comedian in the Bible? Well, it was Samson, because he was always bringing down the walls of the house. Okay. Who was the greatest male financier in the Bible? Okay. Well, that was Noah. He was floating his stock while everyone else was in liquidation. So, the next one. Who was the greatest female financier? Well, that would be Pharaoh's daughter. She went down to the bank of the Nile and drew out a little profit. And then, I got a couple more. Who was the greatest babysitter mentioned in the Bible? Well, that would be David, because he rocked Goliath to a very deep sleep. And the last one, who is the shortest man in the Bible? Well, it's Nehemiah, which is who we're going to be talking about today. Nehemiah is who we're going to be discussing today. And that's kind of what we're kicking off. I'm calling it Rebuilding the Wall. And Nehemiah is a book of the Bible that has a lot of great information in it, but at least for me, it's one of those Bible books that I don't really know a lot about, or I didn't know a lot about. Nehemiah is a man, of course, and we're going to kind of explore this morning a little bit about who Nehemiah is and what he was planning to do and so forth, and kind of have just this general overview of the book of Nehemiah before we begin. But with that, Nehemiah is a book that was written in part and go along with a lot of these other little Old Testament books. So I want to encourage you in your free time at home to take a look at some of these other books, and they are Esther, where you'll discover how God first began to move in the midst of the Israel's captivity by raising up Esther, a young Jewish maiden, to the throne in Persia. It was her husband who is kind of playing a big role in the opening chapters of Nehemiah. And then read the book of Ezra, which is actually part in the Hebrew Bible. Ezra and Nehemiah are actually only one book, but we separate them. So that's linked to the book of Nehemiah. And when you finish with Ezra, I would jump to Nehemiah and read it carefully. Just kind of read through it. It's not a very long book, and it's very interesting to read about what he does. And it'll kind of give you a lot of ideas of what we're going to be talking about in the coming weeks. The richness of the books, these books will get you a better idea of what we will be doing. And so this morning, I actually want to start with a video. It's a really great video, and it kind of ties in and does a lot of heavy lifting for the book of Nehemiah. And so we will watch that here in just a second. Which of these is the lights? Is it this one? No? Well, is that good enough? Or do you want me to turn these lights off too? Okay, well, let's watch this.
The books of Ezra and Nehemiah In most modern Bibles, these books are separate, but that division happened long after it was written. It was originally a unified work written by a single author. The story is set after the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem and its temple and took many of the people into exile. And this book picks up about 50 years later and tells the return of some Israelites to Jerusalem and then what happened when they rebuilt the city and their lives there. Specifically, the book focuses on three key leaders who led the rebuilding efforts. You have Zerubbabel, then Ezra, and then Nehemiah. And the book's design focuses on the efforts of each leader. Zerubbabel leads a large group of people back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. Then about 60 years later, Ezra arrives in Jerusalem to teach the Torah and rebuild the community. And then he's followed by Nehemiah, who leads the rebuilding of Jerusalem's walls. And these three stories are designed to be parallel. Each begins with the king of Persia, prompted by God to send the leader to Jerusalem, and he offers resources and support. And then each leader encounters opposition in their efforts, which they then overcome, but in a way that leads to a strange anticlimax in each of the three parts. Let's back up and see how it fits together. So the story begins with a decree from Cyrus, the king of Persia, and he's moved by God to allow the exiles to return to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. And the author says this fulfills a promise made by the prophet Jeremiah that the exiles would one day return to Jerusalem. Now, this fulfillment should trigger our hopes in the many other prophetic promises that exile was not the end of the story. We have hope for a future messianic king from the line of David. We have hope for a rebuilt temple where God's presence will dwell with his people. Hope for God's kingdom to come over all the nations and bring his blessing, just like he promised Abraham. And so it's with all these hopes in mind that we read on into the story of Zerubbabel. His name means planted in Babylon. He represents the generation born in Babylonian captivity, and he leads a wave of Israelites returning to Jerusalem. After they settle there, they rebuild the altar for offering sacrifices, and later the temple itself. The foundation laying ceremony, and then the temple's final dedication, these are key moments. The past stories of the tabernacle and temple's dedication should be in our minds. This is when the fiery cloud of God's presence is supposed to descend, he's dwelling with his people, and it doesn't happen. And so while some people are happy about this new temple, the elders who had seen the previous temple of Solomon, they cry out in grief. It is nothing like their glorious past or their hopes for the future. And it's right here that we get the first story of opposition, and it's very odd. So the grandchildren of the Israelites, who were not taken into exile, they had been living in Jerusalem all along, they come to offer help with the temple rebuilding. And Zerubbabel refuses. He says, "You have no part in our temple." And this, of course, generates a conflict, which Zerubbabel overcomes, but it's very strange, because the prophets had envisioned that the tribes of Israel would all come together, along with all of the nations, to participate in the worship of the God of Israel when the kingdom finally comes. So this is an anticlimactic moment, to say the least. In the next section, we zoom forward about 60 years and we're introduced to Ezra. He's a leader among the exiled Israelites in Babylon. And he's a Torah scholar and a teacher. And so he gets appointed by Artaxerxes, king of Persia, to lead another wave of people back to Jerusalem. And Ezra wants to bring about spiritual and social renewal among the people. Our hopes are high. And again, we come to another anticlimactic moment in the story. Ezra learns that many of the exiled Israelites that had come back, they had married non-exiles who had been living around Jerusalem. Some of them were non-Israelites, and almost certainly some of them were. Ezra then appeals to the commands of the Torah that Israel was supposed to be holy and separate from the ancient Canaanites. And he then says that the people living around Jerusalem are like the Canaanites. They're going to corrupt the exiles. So Ezra offers a prayer of repentance, and it's very heartfelt. But then he rallies all the leaders and enacts this divorce decree that says all these marriages should be annulled, the women and children sent away. And then the decree is only partially carried out. We're given a list of some of the men who divorced their wives. The story is very strange for a number of reasons. First of all, God never commanded Ezra to do any of this. It was the leaders of Jerusalem who led Ezra to make the decree. Second, the contemporary prophet Malachi, he did say that the exiles should care about purity, but he also said that God was opposed to divorce. And so the mixed results of the decree, this all fits into this pattern of a strange concluding anticlimax. which leads us to the next section about Nehemiah. He's an Israelite official serving in the Persian government, and when he hears about the ruined state of Jerusalem's walls, he prays and then gets permission from the Persian king Artaxerxes to go and rebuild the walls. The king even gives him an armed escort and all these resources. So after arriving in Jerusalem, he begins the building project, and he too faces opposition from the people who had already been living around Jerusalem. Once again, we face a tension in the story. The contemporary prophet Zechariah said that the new Jerusalem of God's kingdom would be a city without walls, that God's presence would surround it, that people from all nations would come and join the covenant people. But Nehemiah seems to operate with the opposite vision. He informs the people surrounding Jerusalem that they have no part in Jerusalem. And this, of course, provokes them to hostility. And so while Nehemiah carries out his vision for the city with integrity and courage, they have to build the city with armed guards to protect them, we keep wondering, could this whole conflict have been handled differently? And this all leads to the conclusion of the book in two movements, first positive and then negative. Ezra and Nehemiah combine forces to bring about a spiritual renewal among the people. They gather all the exiles together for a festival. They read and teach the Torah to all the people for 7 days. And then they celebrate the ancient Feast of Tabernacles to remember God's faithfulness from the Exodus and the wilderness journeys. Then they offer a confession of their sins. They vow themselves to renew the covenant, follow all the commands of the Torah. And they finish with a great celebration over the temple, the walls of Jerusalem, and we're thinking this could be the turning point, but it's not. The book ends on a huge downer. Nehemiah tours around the city, and he finds that the people have not been fulfilling their covenant vows. So Zerubbabel's work is undone as he finds the temple being neglected and staffed by all these unqualified people. He then discovers that Ezra's work is being compromised. He finds everyone violating the Torah, people are working on the Sabbath, and even his own work on the walls is involved because people are setting up markets around the walls of Jerusalem and working on the Sabbath. So Nehemiah, he goes on a rampage. He's beating people up, he's pulling out their hair, and he's yelling, "Obey the commands of the Torah." And his final words are a prayer that God would remember him, that at least he tried, and the book ends. I mean, it's very strange. But we've been prepared for it, right? These anticlimactic moments have been woven into the book's design intentionally. And so it raises the question, what on earth does this book contribute to the storyline of the Bible? Well, remember, the book started by raising our hopes in the prophetic promises about the Messiah, the temple, the kingdom of God, and then none of it happens. So even though Israel is now back in the land, their spiritual state seems unchanged from before the exile. And while Ezra and Nehemiah, they do their best, but their political and social reforms among the people don't address the core issues of their heart. So what the book is pointing out is the same need highlighted by the prophets Jeremiah and Ezekiel. What God's people need is a holistic transformation of their hearts if they're ever going to love and obey their God. And so the book ends on a downer, yes, but it forces you to keep reading on into the wisdom and prophetic books to find out what is God going to do to fulfill his great covenant promises. But for now, that's the book of Ezra and Nehemiah.
Right. So that was a lot of information, and that's kind of why I wanted to have you maybe embrace some of these other books as we lead into Nehemiah, because a lot of them play into the book of Nehemiah, okay? If the Israelites never reestablished themselves back in Israel, there would be no need for a wall, right? I mean, there would be no need for a temple that Ezra started to build. None of this would have been taking place if that wouldn't have happened first. So, I actually recently was taking classes at Tabor College, which is just down the road from here, online, and we did a class just specifically on the book of Nehemiah. And it was very interesting to me to kind of get to see this book. I've read through Nehemiah multiple times and kind of learned a little bit here and there, but getting to see this book laid out in a way that was different. And I was able to see how important Nehemiah was and get to see what a great leader he showed and he became to be known to do, to be. And I'm excited about what God is going to teach us as we travel through this book together as a congregation. But with that, I know we got a lot of history from the video, but I think there's still even more we can learn about Nehemiah in the historical context. So, in Genesis 12, God called Abraham to leave his country, of course, and follow him to another land. As Abraham obeyed, his descendants multiplied, of course. And we know that from all Bible stories throughout the Old Testament. The Israelites were later enslaved in Egypt for over 400 years until God called them out under the leadership of Moses. Eventually, they were allowed to enter the land of God had promised them, which is canon. Hundreds of years passed during which the nation experienced struggles, faithfulness, faithlessness, and wrestling with God. The high point of Israel's history came with David, who is considered to be Israel's first true king, although he was the second king. Saul was the first true actual king, but a lot of Israelites like to believe that David was actually their first king. He was a godly king. He loved God, and he was called to sit on the throne in Israel. So for 40 years, David experienced the nation in both growth of influence between him and the people, and growth between the knowledge of who God was. But things kind of went downhill from there after his son, King Solomon, died. Solomon actually did a lot of great things as well. But when he passed away, Israel was split into two kingdoms, okay? So on one side, they had the northern kingdom and had 10 tribes in it, 10 of the 12 tribes, and it was referred to as Israel, okay? And then you had the southern kingdom, who had just 2 tribes, and it was referred to as Judah. So because of their disobedience, the Assyrians conquered Israel, and the 10 tribes of Israel were scattered, and they became known as the 10 lost tribes. They became known as the 10 lost tribes of Israel, okay? So even though the southern tribes saw all this happen, they too continued to rebel against God, which ultimately led to their own capture. And 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian army captured Jews, Jerusalem was destroyed, the walls were knocked down, and the temple was burned, okay? The people were deported, and they were forced into slavery again, okay? So, their history has kind of come full circle here. The city was left in ruins. Actually, I have a picture of some of the devastation of Hiroshima after the bomb was dropped. And you can kind of see, so this is a big, this church, or what it looks like a church to me. You can see what was left after. And it's kind of amazing to kind of get to see that side by side. Well, for me, I kind of imagine Jerusalem kind of looking like this. You had this great city, these beautiful buildings, this architecture, and then it was just gone, okay? It was in ruins. Like even today, after Jerusalem was kind of destroyed again, you can still see like the layouts of the buildings, like the bottom parts of the stone, and like you can kind of see that. And it's interesting to kind of see what it may have looked like back then. It must have been a traumatic thing for the Jews to see death and destruction, and then be forced to leave their homeland and travel about 1,000 miles to a foreign country. Okay? Many of God's prophets predicted that this captivity would not destroy the nation. It would eventually end, and all the people would be allowed to go back home. Daniel understood this truth when he was reading the book of Jeremiah. God did not forsake his people. He allowed the Persians to take over the Babylonians, and he moved King Cyrus to make a decree to let some of the Jews return. And in three stages, over about 100 years, they were allowed to migrate back to Jerusalem, only discover the city was still demolished and desolate. They were living there with dangerous and difficult, and living there was dangerous and difficult and sorrowful. So, after the decree of Cyrus, 50,000 Israelites returned to Judah with Zer, I'll just call him that, and begin rebuilding the temple. Okay. Unfortunately, they got discouraged and they quit. God then sent them the prophet Haggai and Zechariah to encourage them to finish the project. Ezra was also sent to help restore their spiritual fervor. Okay. So finally, this leads us to Nehemiah. And he starts to tell his story in the 20th year of the reign of Xerxes. Okay. So by now, Persia had replaced Babylon as the region's great power. Okay. And the Persians ruled with a very different means of control. The commitment of the Persians was to resettle captured people into their native lands. Conquered peoples could act with a degree of caution, or as long as they supported the state and paid their taxes, then they were good. Okay, and so this is kind of where we begin here in Nehemiah. And so our scripture reference this morning is actually Nehemiah 1:1-3. If you want to turn there, I will have it on the screen. But that is where we're going to be today. Just a little snippet here. So Nehemiah 1:1-3 says, "These are the words of Nehemiah, son of Hasaliah. It so happened that in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, I was in Susa, the citadel. Hananiah, who was one of my relatives, along with some of the men from Judah, came to me, and I asked them about the Jews who had escaped and had survived the exile and about Jerusalem. They said to me, 'The remnant that remains from the exile there in the province are experiencing considerable adversity and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem lies breached, and its gates have been burned down.'" So, this is the news Nehemiah gets from his friend, his relative. And this kind of puts a hunger in his heart. So, but before we really, as I close, I kind of want to just share a little bit about who Nehemiah was. So, we know that Nehemiah was the son of a slave, of course, because he was an Israelite in Persia. We got a lot of information from the video, but we have a little bit more. Nehemiah was a Jew and the son of a prisoner of war. He had a very close and personal relationship with God. He had a great government job in the Persian kingdom. Nehemiah was the cupbearer to King Xerxes the first, and at a time when Judah and Palestine had been partially repopulated by Jews released from their exile in Babylon. He had to be a moral, he had to be honest man, or else he would be susceptible to bribery from others because of his position. Okay? The king had much trust in Nehemiah. Nehemiah was a great leader and saw leadership as a holy partnership with God. So, the temple at Jerusalem had been rebuilt, but the Jewish community there was dispersed and defenseless against its non-Jewish neighbors. Distressed at news of the condition of Jerusalem, Nehemiah obtained permission from Xerxes to journey to Palestine to help rebuild its ruined structures. Okay? He was provided actually with an escort, which is a pretty good deal in my book. He had documents that guaranteed the assistance of the Judah's Persians officials. Like, the king Xerxes set Nehemiah up for success, okay? And it's amazing to have that kind of backing, especially at that time. So about 444 BC, Nehemiah journeyed to Jerusalem and aroused the people there to the necessity of repopulating the city and rebuilding its walls, okay? Which is not an easy feat to do. These people weren't wall builders. They weren't in construction, many of them. They were just normal people with normal jobs, as we will see later on in the series. Nehemiah encountered hostility from the non-Jewish local officials and neighboring districts, but in the space of 52 days, the Jews under his direction succeeded in rebuilding Jerusalem walls. Okay? 52 days. That is crazy to think about. And they did not have this machinery that we would have today. I feel like 52 days to build a wall around a city today would be a pretty impressive feat. But that was back then, 52 days. Later on, Nehemiah actually served as the governor of a small district of Judah for 12 years, during which he overtook various religious and economic reforms before returning to Persia. So Nehemiah, of course, could have easily been concerned for Jerusalem from Persia, okay? He had a very comfortable job. Yes, he was still considered a slave, but he probably did not live as a slave. He lived in the kingdom. He lived as the right-hand man to King Xerxes. And he had a great position. But he decided, through his calling from God, to give that up to serve God in this way. He didn't stay in Persia. He listened to God, and he followed his call back to Jerusalem. So, as we can start this series, it's broken up into many sections, and there's many divisions that this book falls into, and we're going to kind of look through those in the coming many weeks. We got the first six chapters that cover the rebuilding of the wall specifically, while the chapters 7 through 10 deal with the renewing of Jerusalem's worship, with the final chapters addressing the repopulation and revival of God's people. And so this has just kind of been a snippet of kind of who Nehemiah was and what he did and where he came from and why he did it. And as we go throughout these next few weeks, we will get to kind of see how he did it and what he did to put himself in those positions and how he relied on God in so many different ways. And it's just a great book, and I'm looking forward to continuing this throughout these next few weeks. And so with that, let's close in prayer, and we will close with a song, and then we will be dismissed for the day. So